slipped a different panel in on you. The panel now, to my right, is Justice Sue Walker. To my left, Justice Bob McCoy. And I'm Leanne Dopino. You are specially set today, and that's why you're here at a special time. So, if you'll call the case, I understand both sides are ready, and we'll proceed.
The court will now call in the decision of the
Please, the court, counsel. I'm Richard Gladstone. I represent Daniel Brown, the appellant in this matter. I'm going to basically spend the majority of my time dealing with the D&E issues, and maybe if I have a little time left over, talk about the intervention issue. Of course, the court's aware this case has come back to y'all after a prior decision. The case was initially tried in June of 2009. My client's parental rights were terminated by the trial court on the 322nd. Finding D&E at that point. The case came up on appeal to y'all, and y'all rendered a decision in July 2010, basically reversing and remanding, finding that the evidence was factually insufficient to support the D&E findings. That decision came down in July. I believe y'all's mandate, the mandate came down in November. Shortly thereafter, trial setting was done for the case. Go back on the jury docket. CPS came down with a service plan recommending termination. Services weren't done. My client was granted no visitation at that point by CPS, and the case went to trial in February 2011. Went to jury trial. The jury at that point terminated again on D&E grounds and found again that termination was in my client's, in the child's best interest. The evidence that was presented in the second trial was substantially the same as the first trial. I want to say it was even more than just substantially the same. I think it was identical and sometimes verbatim. It was hard to avoid that with this court's opinion in our left hand, the trial court's record in the right hand, and the same witnesses coming before the court and trying this. It is our position that this case is governed by what's called the law of the case. And when the law is the same, and we know the law is the same, D&E under 161, and the evidence is substantially the same, that the outcome accordingly should be the same. And again, our position is there were a lot of different witnesses that were presented the second time around, lay witnesses, CPS workers, some counselors, whatever, but substantially the same experts testified the second time. The nurse practitioners, the doctors on the scenes, the experts. And their testimony was almost word for word what they testified the first time around. So I think in view of the fact that, you know, this court spent a great deal of time, I believe 45 pages, analyzing all the evidence the first time and going through all the experts' testimony, their analysis, whatever, spent a great deal analyzing the facts. If you look at that record and this record, it's not going to vary very much. Again, there were some other lay witnesses that testified to other ancillary matters, but the essence of this was really tied down to the experts' testimony.
Which specific witnesses testified at the second trial that did not testify at the first?
I can tell you which ones did. It was basically Donna Wright, the nurse practitioner from Cook's. She was a repeat witness. And Dr. Lazarus, who testified about the failure to thrive. Those were the two major witnesses. I believe there's another doctor that testified, but his testimony didn't vary much.
But I was trying to determine which witnesses were different.
As to lay witnesses, I believe they brought up a couple of CPS workers. One that came up and analyzed the Missouri records, local CPS worker analyzed the Missouri records. She testified. There was a witness, a probation officer for Daniel Brown's girlfriend. She came up and testified. There were some people from the apartment as to the condition of the apartment later on, well after removal, well after the termination, as the conditions in my client's apartment. That may have been it. I know there were a few more witnesses, but those are the ones I remember, Judge.
Okay.
The issues in the first trial were basically the injury to child, the failure to thrive issue, and the domestic violence. The injury to the child issue was that my client, of course, denied that he caused the injury. The evidence I would have to stipulate from the nurse practitioners and the doctors were that there was an injury that took place. It was a non-accidental injury. And Donna Wright testified the first time and the second time that this was caused by a slap to the face and possibly a pinch to the ear. And the testimony of both trials was pretty consistent. This was one incident. There were a few little bumps and bruises on the child that they didn't think was of any great significance. But the major injury, the black and blue linear marks on the child's face, the purple ear, from one incident. And this court, you know, this court held the first time that, you know, that it did appear that it was an injury to the child, but this court ruled that it looked like it wasn't a continuing course of conduct. There was no prior testimony in either trial, especially the second trial, that my client had ever injured the child at any other time. This was a one-time isolated incident. Now, in the appellee's brief, they try to kind of, in a sense, bootstrap, saying, well, my client was rude, abrasive, argumentative to CPS workers. He yelled at some people. He was, wasn't very polite to these people. And therefore, since he was aggressive with these people, verbally aggressive with other folks during the case, that we can basically extrapolate that he was a violent person, and this one isolated incident becomes more than that. I don't think you can make that quantum jump from one injury to a child to being rude to the CPS workers. I just don't think there's that bridge there. So I think we're left with one incident that was not a course of conduct. And again, nurse practitioner Wright testified pretty much the same the first time as the second time. There was a slap mark, there was a pinch, and basically there was nothing more. The second situation, of course, was the failure to thrive. And I think the evidence was clear from both cases was that during that period, the wife, for better or worse, was in charge of the child's care. Very backward, whatever, my client kind of deferred to her. He didn't have a car. The mother was being taken to the doctors with her sister, and they were going to Cook Clinics during all that spring of that year. I think they made two or three visits to Cook Clinics, and no one really raised an issue at that point from the doctors that the child was failing to thrive back then. The mother didn't know it, the aunt didn't know it, and nothing was communicated to my client whatsoever. Of course, a few months later, the crisis took place. The child was in the mother's care at that point. She did the proper thing. She called 911. The child was transported to the hospital. They diagnosed failure to thrive. My client basically took the position that, yes, he was seeing the children occasionally, and he didn't see it. And the testimony from Dr. Lazarus and nurse practitioner Wright in the second trial was that if they weren't aware there's a problem, if the father wasn't notified that there was a problem, and he was seeing the child kind of frequently but not all the time, he would not recognize that failure to thrive. And that was the testimonies from the experts, Dr. Lazarus, and I think nurse practitioner Wright kind of reaffirmed that. He had no knowledge, and the court held the first time that if a party doesn't have knowledge, they can't be faulted. And of course, the state says that, you know, basically, my client had his head in the sand and that he was ignoring all this. Well, he was out of the circle. The mother kind of knew from her visits to Cook's clinic. The aunt kind of knew, and they did nothing. The aunt at some point kind of lobbied the mother, harangued the mother about getting something done, but nothing ever happened until the crisis. In fact, when the child was removed the first time, the child was placed with the aunt, who was well aware of the failure to thrive or had inkling of it and had done nothing. So I just don't see, again, that my client could be faulted for that. And again, the evidence was substantially the same the first as the second time. The third third issue that came up was more so in the first trial than the second trial was the domestic violence in the household. Testimony the first time was that there were times when the mother came over that she was prohibited from seeing the child because the child was in my client's care for 2 or 3 weeks. She barged into the door of his home, struck him a couple times. Once he kind of escorted her to the door, next time she was given a citation for violence. So most of the violence at that point was from mom to dad. Really wasn't an issue in the second trial because mom didn't testify. Her rights had been terminated. She wasn't before the court, so it didn't really come up. The last issue was maybe a little bit more filled out the second time than it did the first time, and that were living conditions. The first trial, it was determined that my client was living in an apartment. Probably wasn't up to par, probably wasn't up to snuff, but when it came time for the child to be returned to him for those 3 or 4 weeks that he had the child, he did what was necessary to bring the apartment up. He got food in the apartment, cleaned it up, got some furniture. He was adequate for the CPS worker. He was adequate for the Volunteers of America, and the child was returned. The state, in the second case, basically put on a lot of evidence as to my condition of my client's apartment well after the fact. After the termination, he hadn't seen the child in 2 years, hadn't had possession of the child for 2 years. They brought some people in from the apartment, basically saying that he was still keeping kind of a dirty apartment. I don't think that's relevant to D&E. Maybe best interest out there, but I don't think it was relevant to D&E. I don't think, again, the evidence of conditions in his house endangered the child, because all the times that he had the child, the apartment was adequate. Maybe marginal, but at least adequate, and he didn't endanger the child. They did spend a lot of time filling that out by bringing in more from the Missouri records. At some point, when the first child was born, the second child wasn't around, the family lived up in Missouri in some trailers. And there was a referral made that conditions in trailer number 5 were inadequate. And the Missouri CPS came out and investigated. They never saw trailer number 5. They came over to another trailer where my client was staying. And the CPS worker in this trial attempted to interpret the CPS records from Missouri, and basically it was established they had never seen the offending trailer, and the records were somewhat inconclusive. One record, one little box was checked, the place was unsanitary and endangering the child. There's another box on another form saying the house was adequate and clean. So even though she tried to interpret the records coming out of Missouri were very inconclusive. So again, those were the same issues. The testimony was the same. I believe that there was nothing major that was brought out of the second trial that wasn't before this court the first time in all the analysis this court did on all extensive analysis this court did on the facts the first time around. And I believe based on that this court again should reverse with possible direction to the trial court to make appropriate orders in this matter to get it resolved so it doesn't come back over and over and over again. So that's pretty much my argument on D&E. If you have any questions on that before I go into the intervention issue. Okay. Let me go ahead and go into the intervention issue. Early on in the case, the children were with the aunt, and then they went to another foster home for a short while, and that foster home broke down. Sometime in February 2009, the children went over to the Harps. And that was about 3.5 months before the first trial took place. What we did, knowing that the foster parents were gaining time to get standing and they might have standing at some point, we filed a motion for speedy trial in this termination case. It was a little unusual, but I went ahead and did it, and the court granted it. And we went to trial in February 2009. At that point, the Harps had the children for 3.5 months. I don't believe that's sufficient to have standing. At that point, of course, the case went to trial. My client's parental rights were terminated, went up on appeal, was on appeal for, of course, a fair amount of time, came back. This court reversed and remanded. And at that point, they filed an intervention. And my legal argument was and is, yes, they had a lot of time with the child, and that should be standing. But are they entitled to claim all that time that they, in a sense, wrongfully had the child. The analogy might be if some parent has the child out of state in violation of an order or an abduction, whatever, are they entitled to claim standing by having the child wrongfully held? And there are a number of cases that I cite in my brief, and they're none of them on point, but basically there are cases out there in civil law regarding statute of limitations that when a case is decided and it's reversed, basically that party doesn't get the benefit of the time the case is on appeal when there's a termination, when there's a reversal, that they shouldn't be basically benefiting from that wrongful time. And I'm not saying the Harps did anything wrong or anyone else did anything wrong, but there was a termination and there was a passage of time where my client was unjustifiably denied possession of his child and had to stay in foster care, and they were, in a sense, using that wrongful time to establish standing. And I realize there is
what's the remedy for that? I mean, I'm not saying how that impacts the 161 grounds that were...
Oh, I don't think so at all. I think it's a totally separate issue, Judge.
So what remedy are you asking for?
Well, at that point, early on, of course, I was asking that the intervention be struck, and that was overruled. Prior to the first trial, I asked that the intervention be struck, because my position is the dynamics of a trial, when you go into a jury trial and you have the poor pitiful respondent over here, the father or the mother over here, and you have CPS, and then you have the foster parents coming in saying, oh gosh, we have a wonderful home, we have a cottage in the country, here are the pictures of children in the and pictures of children in the blue bonnets. And my client at that point hadn't seen his child for 2 years. We had no pictures, and I kind of referenced this in my brief. He had nothing to present to the judge, to the jury, and it kind of put someone at a real disadvantage that we have this stability over here and my client's been left out in the cold for 2 years, and it's a matter of,
well,
you know,
that might impact the best interest grounds.
It could, yes.
But I'm not seeing as how the intervention has any impact whatsoever on the analysis of the DNA ground.
It might have a bearing on the jury's likeliness or willingness to terminate, knowing that we have a better home out there, and of course we know the rule that we can't terminate just because there's a better home out there, but they see this better home, and I think the proclivity might be that there's a better home out there, it's here, they've intervened, there's stability, we have all these pictures of the children doing well in the home, and I think they're much more inclined possibly to say, well gosh, it's a lot easier to terminate in this situation. So it rolls over to the DNA, not directly, but it does roll over. So that's kind of where I am. Any questions, please? No, we're not. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. Very good.
Here is the 115-page opinion written by Judge Walker with detailed analysis of the facts. Are there witnesses who testified the second time that did not testify? The first time is obviously the question we have after this is what's new?
Ten new witnesses.
Witnesses who testified in trial number one that did not testify?
Yes. That would be... I think what we're seeing in the second trial are additional witnesses that sometimes the new witnesses are testifying consistent with what another witness in the first trial might have talked about. But what they're also adding is our added layers to the life of these children.
Okay, that's not my question.
Okay.
The question is, witnesses testified in both cases, is it the same testimony?
For the most part, I would say that is correct. I can't think of any particular...
So we're looking for new evidence.
Yes.
Above and beyond what's in here. We're going to look for the new witnesses that testified, and we're going to take out the witnesses that didn't testify the second time.
Yes.
A little unusual
And I think what was presented in the second case is enough, does rise to the level of endangerment. The jury, there were 20 total witnesses in the second case, 54 exhibits. 10 of those witnesses were new. And what they painted to the jury was a picture that the life with Mr. Brown was one that exposed them to a relatively relentless environment of hostility and anger. A consistent pattern of his conduct through his acts and omissions that endangered the children. Not just the physical. They didn't hear about just one physical assault. The jury did not. They didn't hear about just a dirty apartment or a spat between Mr. Brown and his wife. What they saw was this pattern of behavior. Every time Mr. Brown had a supervised visitation at CPS, a time when the real purpose is to reestablish his relationship with the children, to show CPS officials that he was a capable parent, instead he was spending the majority, or at least a substantial portion of that time, berating them, verbally abusing them. Val Trammell was one of the new witnesses. She was a case aide with CPS for 23 years. She was present for each of Mr. Brown's supervised visits from October 2008 to June 2009. And her testimony was that at the beginning of every single visit, instead of immediately going to his children, he'd spend a substantial portion of that time berating the CPS official, who was often Lamora Cornelius, who was also a witness that testified in the second trial that did not testify in the first trial. Her testimony was that he would yell and scream and make demands and threats to sue CPS. And these weren't just examples of a parent upset with what was going on. I think that Mr. Gladstone referred to them as him being rude or impolite. These were not just poor manners. Brian Knox, a CPS investigator who also testified in the second trial, did not testify in the first, said he'd never seen a dad act like this. Val Trammell also testified that security at the CPS facility had to come down on more than one occasion to attempt to redirect Mr. Brown off of his rants. A couple of the visits had to be stopped short because he couldn't control himself. Brian Knox, one of the new witnesses, was present at the hospital in July of 2008 after Adrian was taken for the injury to the head. And it was his testimony. He was present in the room when Mr. Brown gave the particularly crude comment to the officer. And it's not just that he's behaving in this way or that he's exhibiting this rage, but he's doing it in front of the kids. That's the real problem with this. When he made that particularly crude comment to the police officer, he did it while he was holding Haley in his left arm. Another one of the new witnesses was Dr. Parnell Ryan, who was a psychologist, who was asked about the effect of inappropriate behavior in front of children. And it was his testimony that when children observe inappropriate behavior, any kind of behavior exhibited by a parent, appropriate or inappropriate, they are apt to mimic that behavior. And it was his, and Dr. Ryan testified that observing that inappropriate behavior endangers their emotional well-being. And that's part of the additional new evidence here that was not present in the second trial. Was not present in the first trial. And it's that new evidence that will permit the court not to view this assault on Adrian in isolation or to view it as a single incident, but instead as the physical culmination of what is a man who is completely unwilling, not that he's unable, but that he's unwilling to conform himself and control this rage and this hostility. So it's not necessary to view the physical assault alone. The children's emotional and potentially physical well-being is placed in danger by Mr. Brown's persistent conduct. And that's exactly what the jury heard. The jury heard all of the same evidence from the first trial. But in addition, they heard from all these other witnesses that painted a more thorough picture of what the life of what life is like with Mr. Brown. And that sort of leads into the failure to thrive diagnosis that the little girl received. I, of course, had the very thorough opinion by the court from the first time. I didn't participate in either stage of the first trial. I don't know. I've not actually seen that record. But what I do know is the defenses that Mr. Brown threw out, he threw out the first time, that he didn't know that Haley was malnourished. He wasn't aware. Nobody told him. And his testimony in this case was that if nobody tells him, then technically he's not responsible. And in the first trial, after the court's opinion 18 months ago, that was found to be factually insufficient because he was never told. And that, according as Mr. Gladstone pointed out, there was nothing that was obvious about this, that Dr. Lazarus and Nurse Wright said there was nothing obvious, that a parent wouldn't necessarily know. But the specific question, at least in the second trial, the specific question to the doctors was whether or not the doctor or Nurse Wright, whether a parent would notice a decrease of 5% on the growth chart. And the doctor and Nurse Wright both said that would be really hard for a parent who sees the child every day to notice. But we're not talking about a 5% drop. Haley, from February of 2007 to May of 2007, a three-month period, she dropped nearly 3 pounds, almost 20% of her entire body weight. And that was a time period which Mr. Brown was living in the home. This is prior to his separation and having moved out. It's somewhat inconceivable for Mr. Brown to say that he didn't know any of this was going on. When he was present, he was there. There's some disagreement as to how much time he had with the children after the separation, but in that time period where he was still in the home, she had her largest weight loss, and the child was in danger then and continued to be in danger. And I think based upon that, there was sufficient evidence for the jury to find that the children were both, their physical and emotional well-being was in danger. Thank you. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Jeff Kaitzer. I represent the interveners, Greg and Julie Harp, in this case. They did not participate in the first trial. Our knowledge of what went on in the first trial, of course, is limited to the prior opinion in this case, as well as an examination of the record. Mr. Gladstone went over briefly one aspect of the case that affects in particular my clients, and it's the ability to file an intervention, and I will spend some time, a little bit of time, talking about that. Mr. Gladstone candidly admitted that he's really asking the court to extend some sort of an equitable argument that the standing provision set out in the Texas Family Code that allows foster parents who've had children in their home for 12 months, if they were placed by the Department of Family and Protective Services, that somehow there needs to be engrafted upon that a provision that says, well, you can't use time if a case is on appeal. And that's really not what the statute says. He's asking the court to undertake a reading of that that's simply not in the case. The plain fact of the matter is, and he's trying to somehow argue by implication that this is a wrongful time period. Well, in the cases that he tries to analogize to, Mr. Gladstone tries to show that when you have an extension of a statute of limitation or some other fact such as that, there's something that's gone on that's wrongful, like a wrongful removal of a child from a jurisdiction. That's absolutely not what we have here. Therefore, as the court well knows, the test for determining whether or not an intervention should be struck was abuse of discretion. We do not think the court abused her discretion in this case. The issues that were tried were exactly the same. They were no more complicated by the existence of my clients being in the lawsuit than they would have been otherwise. Two cases out of this court that are cited in our brief, I think, talk about the analysis that should be used when you determine whether or not an intervention should be struck. We don't think that there was any error by Judge Berger in refusing to strike the intervention. I believe the only my clients didn't participate in the first trial, and by the time they got around to us, I think the only witnesses that we called that were not called by either Mr. Gladstone or the state, Missy Pascoe, who was the state, was probably my clients. They were the only witnesses that I would have called that were not called by other people. However, I do want to talk a little bit about the witnesses who, one of the witnesses in particular who was not called, Dr. Pernell Ryan. Dr. Ryan's testimony is, I think, particularly instructive and is puts a little bit of a different spin on this situation. He testified that Daniel Brown has no insight into his actions. He doesn't understand what it means to be a parent. He doesn't understand how his actions or inactions can affect these children. What Dr. Ryan and Dr. Ryan did, I believe, three separate psychological evaluations of Mr. Brown while this case was going on. And when a parent has no insight into himself, into parenting, into children, he is likely to act in ways that we have seen possibly in this case that we think the evidence is raised. Mr. Gladstone tried to point out that, well, this is just a one-slap case. Well, that slap, or whatever it was, and there's some, Mr. Brown testified on a number of different levels about that. And the jury, we had 12 jurors in there, and they're entitled to judge this man's credibility who testified before them and determine what was credible and what was not. And they listened to his explanation, and Mr. Gladstone says, well, after the slap was discovered, I believe July 8th of 2009, there was never any repeat of any incident like that. And the reason for that is because this man never had any access to those children. He has no insight into his own behavior. He doesn't understand what the parenting roles are. There are non-delegable parental duties are set out in the family code. This man is incapable of carrying out those duties. Now, as far as the other evidence that was presented, besides Dr. Ryan, and there were nine other witnesses, I did read the court's early decision. I did read the reporter's record from the first trial. The evidence that was adduced before the jury in the second trial by many of the witnesses who testified in both, I thought went into far greater detail about the potential damage to these children and the ill effects that they suffered and had the potential to suffer while they're in the care of this man's supervision. With regard to, Dr. Lazarus went into some detail, greater detail than he did in the first trial, concerning the effect of head growth tracking brain growth. Unchecked, non-occurring head growth yields non-occurring brain growth, which yields retardation. Donna Wright testified failure to give proper nutrition can result in language and motor delays, can permanently endanger the child's physical and emotional well-being. The evidence that was adduced from these witnesses was in far greater detail, in my opinion, than it was the first time around. And then when you look at what happened in the time during which the child was returned after the initial removal back in 2007, Mr. And once again, this goes back to the insight that Dr. Ryan finds totally lacking. Mr. Brown knows he's under close scrutiny. Does he keep the place clean? Well, the first time that there was a visit, not with the children, but from a professional worker, the place was clean. Then there are supervised visits. And as time goes along during these supervised visits, and they take place only over about a 2 to 3 month period, the place is becoming worse and worse. There's a foul odor. There's stench. The facts of this case are remarkably similar to a case decided by this court about 2 months ago called In Re HNH that this court issued. The facts are very, very similar in terms of the environment of the child. As he finally began to get visitations and unsupervised visitations over a period of between, say, April and May, the children were not bathed, they did not appear to be fed, and that's pointed out in the record. He has the child returned to him unsupervised on approximately June 10th of 2008. Every visit after that got progressively worse. Progressively worse. And what Mr. Gladstone would have us do is wait until there's something serious. Well, I would submit to you that we should not have to wait until we hear about this case on the 10 o'clock news. This man has had numerous chances to try to make sure that he doesn't endanger the children. His failure to uphold his parental duties that he's supposed to under the family code has clearly put these children in danger before, certainly physically as to the failure to thrive, emotionally as to nutrition, as to behavior, as to his own lack of insight in his own behavior and his own parenting. And we would submit to you that this man has in fact placed his children in physical and emotional danger, and that this court should not disturb the judgment of the jury. Thank you.
Thank you. Richard.
Thank you. Justice McCoy, you asked about new witnesses. They were testifying the second time. They didn't testify the first time. And the appellee raised the issue that Ms. Cornelius testified the second time, didn't testify the first time. And Mr. Knox testified the second time, didn't testify the first time. And they were the supervisors of the visitation. Well, if we remember from your decision, Mr. Brown went up there and had conflicts with his actual caseworker that was there time in, time out, time in, again, Ruth Groomer. And that was the conflict. And this court held, well, my client was alleging the first time that that woman had a vendetta against him. And this court, I believe you ruled that these contentions are somewhat supported by the record, the evidence in the record. So he was fussing at this woman, fussing back and forth, maybe not making the best use of his time, but because of, you know, Ms. Groomer's situation, my client's situation, Ms. Groomer didn't testify the second time, so they brought the other case aides come in to say the same thing. Ms. Groomer testified the first time. The visits didn't go well. There was a lot of conflict. He busted her rather than visiting sometimes. So these two new witnesses came in and said the same thing. And this happened in the second trial time and time again. Rather than having something the first witness testify, you put on, you know, you have new actors coming in and saying the same thing. And the same thing's true of Dr. Ryan. Dr. Ryan didn't testify the first time, but unless my recollection fails me, he had three psychological evaluations that were submitted into evidence. I could be wrong, but I believe they were. They were before the trial court the first time. The second trial, Dr. Ryan did, in fact, testify in person. And in my brief, Dr. Ryan testified that in his professional opinion, the father did not present a danger to his children when he last evaluated him in January 2011. This was a month before the second trial. And the father at that point had been off his psychotropic medication for over a year. So Dr. Ryan, who testified the first time, didn't testify the first time, testified the second time. And when he last saw him, the third or fourth time, he did not present a danger to the child. So again, this is a situation where we're getting the same different actors saying the same thing. And again, I think this case, again, rises and falls on the testimony of nurse practitioner Wright and Dr. Lazarus. And it's cited in my brief. They both said, because they had to say it again, because they said it the first time, that a father in Daniel Brown's situation might not recognize that failure to thrive. The doctors at the clinic in the spring that year didn't recognize it, and he didn't recognize it. And they did not fault the father. And that testimony, I think, is crucial to that case. And again, we had another doctor talk about the injury. We know, well, I assume, there was an injury. And the evidence is clear, and I have to acknowledge that it was basically a non-accidental, probably non-accidental injury. But again, it was one slap and one pinch. And this court cited a number of cases that I had previously cited that a slap is not enough to change custody, much less terminate on. And I think that your opinion is significant because, overall, because it tends to show that it's maybe harder to, it shouldn't be easier to prove and sustain a termination, the evidence of a termination case, over and above a custody case. So in my brief, I get into parental presumption. And there are a number of parental presumption cases that start talking about the bad conditions in mom and one parent's home, and that's still not enough to change to a non-parent. And you start combining those two things, and you see the burden is very, very high in a termination case. Again, they talked about the visits to my father, the dad's home, the visits that came later, well after the events. There's no way, it may have been best interest, but this was a year, 2 years after the children had been removed. Department managers came in and said he still had a, you know, smell in his apartment. It was messy, whatever. So a lot of things they're talking about, the visits and the apartment and all those things, are kind of best interest. We are boiled down to significant evidence, first trial, second trial, maybe different actors, but pretty much the same testimony that you had before that you analyzed the first time. Yes, thank you. That's all I have. Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate your argument. I know this has been a lot of work for everybody, and we are not unaware of that. And we appreciate what you've done in this case. All right. Well, you are excused to go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.
Thank you.
All rise.